It's become something of a custom in recent years for me to offer a few thoughts about the history of this parish on the occasion of the Patronal Festival. Oddly enough, I've just finished writing a chapter on how this church all began, so there's a certain appropriateness about it all. In fact, I got marked by my supervisor in a little supervision session on Friday, so here we go. This parish began in 1864. The Reverend E.G. Edwards, who was then the Dean of St. Paul's Cathedral, called a meeting at the Edinburgh Hotel at the end of this road of local lay people, and they acted quite swiftly, really from January to March, to erect a small wooden church up on the embankment at the intersection of Eastbourne Street, as we now call it, and South Road. And this was the gathering place for Anglicans. Anglicans had gotten first. It took the Presbyterians another 5 years before they had a church here, and the Baptists another year after that. So far, so good. The problem was that while local people had been quite okay about raising some money to build this little wooden church, they weren't so keen about regularly stumping up money to pay the stipend of a resident clergyman. And this caused big problems in the years ahead, in what came to be a series of revolving door ministries, none of them lasting more than 2 or 3 years. I think one of the problems had been that people had come from Britain with a kind of expectations about the Church of England that obtained there. In other words, it was like a public utility. You went there to be hatched, matched and dispatched without having to pay for it. There were huge assets that the Church of England had, and really it didn't expect lay people to make sacrificial contributions to the life of their parish. Baptists and Methodists and other Free Church Christians had known from way back that they, if they wanted a local church and they wanted ministry to look after them, they had to pay for it. So they had a head start, really, in getting going in this very different context in New Zealand, in which all the churches would be voluntary churches, dependent on the support of their membership. Perhaps the most interesting of those revolving door ministries was the Reverend Sotham, who was vicar both of Port Chalmers and this place. He'd been an old sea dog. He'd captained troop ships running from Britain to India and Abyssinia. He'd run an iron ship running the Waitangi between Britain and New Zealand, and he came to ministry in the second half of his life. After he left here, he became a very popular vicar of Lyttelton, where he's left a local legend. He used to sleep in his coffin during Lent to remind himself and others of the mortality of life. Began to change was when the Reverend William Ronaldson became the vicar of this parish in 1881, and what an interesting life he'd had up till then. He'd gone to sea at first and then discovered that being a sailor wasn't for him, because after 18 months on a whaler, he discovered his vulnerability to persistent seasickness. So he came back to New Zealand and farmed on a relative's farm in the Whanganui area, where he developed an interest in local Maori people and in missionary work amongst them. He taught in a missionary school at a local pā. He learned to speak Maori. He returned to Britain, went to a missionary college to get himself trained and ordained. And after he was trained and ordained in the Diocese of London and married a local woman, he returned to New Zealand to run, first of all, a Maori boarding school in the area around Masterton. Local hauhau Maori were very active then. He claimed to be a friend of Major Kemp, who was a famous kūpapa, chief war warrior. He was one of the officiants at the funeral of Te Rāparaha, and he'd also acted as a translator for Tamihana Te Rāparaha when he appeared before Queen Victoria. Well, the boarding school only lasted 3 years. He went to run an industrial school for Maori people at Machueka, and then he became vicar of Picton, vicar of St. John's Milton, and then came here in his 50s. I think determined to make his mark, recognising it was probably his last parish. He was already the diocesan secretary, so he was quite a well-organised kind of person, and he immediately said that it was important to move the church from South Road into what we call here Parkside, where the population development was now occurring around the fact that This had become a very industrial suburb. The immigration barracks were here. The local railway workshops were here. And local laity became enthusiastic about that. And so this land was purchased and it was resolved to build a church here. Now, Bishop Neville gave three clear warnings. Build in non-permanent material. Build in wood. Don't get into debt. You might want to build something more permanent later on. But the building committee ignored all that and pressed ahead. I think because there was a local brickworks close by, brick was a very popular building material with Victorian people. They saw it as long-lasting and cheap, and so they pressed ahead. And they employed Mr. Hardy, a very well-known Dunedin citizen architect, to do the work. They accepted the lowest tender, and construction began in 1882. And they became, the building committee, quite concerned right from the go-get. There was leaking windows. They became concerned about the west wall. Were the foundations sufficient? And they began to get worried about the tower. So as relationships became more difficult with Mr. Hardy, by the way, he hadn't actually been trained as an architect. Very few architects were. He'd been a builder, a cabinet maker, and had sort of learnt on the job. And the one church he had built, St. John's Roslyn, a wooden structure, was of course on much more permanent soil. So in the end, Petrie, the famous architect who created the Catholic cathedrals in Christchurch and Dunedin, was called in to give a second opinion and correctly identified the problem that the west wall was on a lean, the tower was on a 6-inch lean, the foundations were not adequate, and it would be a very bad idea to put a spire on the top of the tower as they were planning to do. In the end, the whole issue went to arbitration, which found in favour of the parish. So when this church opened on the Feast of St. Michael and All Angels in late September 1882, it was surrounded with what you might call the fires of contestation. Very appropriate, you might argue, that St. Michael, the warrior angel, had been the occasion to open the church. Well, there were no other places, there was no hall or Sunday school room. There were two Sunday schools meeting in two dispersed areas with 270 children under instruction. They needed to have some kind of public assembly building. Once again, Ronaldson was a galvanising agent. He said to the vestry, "Look, I've just found out there's two redundant school rooms at Green Island. Let's buy them, transport them on site, reassemble them, and that'll be the hall." And apparently he bought the land also on which this was going to happen. Well, so a month later, what would be the hall and Sunday school for the next over 100 years came on site. That wasn't replaced until the 1980s. Well, by now, the parish had been borrowing heavily to make it happen. The optimistic assumptions about what would fund it all had come to be somewhat unrealistic. The land on which the old church had stood didn't sell until the early 20th century, despite the progress of legislation through the House of Parliament and through the Diocesan Synod. I think it's inaccessible site, inaccessibility, and it's being next to the gasworks may have had something to do with it being an unpopular purchase for others to make. They thought they'd sell off the old church for £1,000. They got £150 from the emerging Mornington parochial district. That church, I might add, stood there until the latter part of the 20th century. And when Ashley Day's father, who was then the priest, built the new St. Mary's Mornington. And then the long depression of New Zealand that lasted from the late 1870s right through the 1880s and into the early 1890s began to blight the hopes of the parish. At first, Dunedin is New Zealand's premier city that had benefited, in fact, from the rural recession that was industrialising rapidly, was immune to the effect of all this. But in the end, it began to have a devastating effect on people, and many thousands of people left Australia. And so that began to be a significant problem. The debt problems piled up. There were threats from the local bank about moving on those who had acted as the guarantors. And by 1887, it meant that Ronaldson had to go because the parish was now in serious trouble. Despite the major efforts of some of the local parishioners to save him, its ministry, the Women's Guild, which would emerge as a very significant lay organisation in terms of raising funds to make things happen, stumped up over £100 towards a stipend. He was involved in rent-a-priest schemes, taking regular services at the cathedral or Roslyn to raise extra income for a stipend. Remember, in those days, lay readers often took the services on Sunday morning because matins and litany was the regular thing. A priest was only required often once a month at some churches to celebrate the Holy Communion service. Well, he went in 1887, but Bishop Neville wanted to save him, so he created this new position, chaplain to public institutions, which meant he looked after the jail, the hospital, the benevolent institution, remember that neo-Dickensian structure at the end of Eastbourne Street, and he had a ministry also to the industrial school. You can still see that up there on Rocky Side. There'd been a really interesting power play there. It was run by the Salvation Army. It was for girls who had either been orphaned or were seen to be in moral danger in the families where they were living. And the master of the industrial school had denied the Anglican priest permission to go and give religious instruction to the girls who were Anglicans. And so the local synod reached out to the Premier of New Zealand, Sir John Hall, a practicing Anglican, who spoke strongly to the master, and from then on the vicar was allowed to go to the industrial school. You see, Anglicans still had that hangover attitude from the old country that chaps with chaps in the corridors of power will make things work for us. We are the premier Protestant denomination. Well, so by 1887 Ronaldson was gone. He was conscientious in the exercise of his new duties. Remember the Reverend Vincent Bryan King, the son of Bryan King, the vicar who changed everything here, would become New Zealand's premier social worker priest in that position in the early 20th century and cover himself in glory in it. But that was to come much later. And so this church was there in the late 1880s, but it owed a whole lot of money. The next priest, the Reverend Watson, was also immolated on the altar of parish debt. And it wasn't until Bryan King came in the early 1890s and slowly turned things around through his conciliation skills, I think his business skills and his pastoral conscientiousness, that the parish got itself onto a reasonably stable platform. Okay, that's it.